Well, first off, I'd like to start the evening to thank Greg and whoever was together to invite me. I would love to be there with you, but I was just talking before this thing started that I met my wife in 1960. We were both 14 years old, and we're both well over 75. And I don't want to go someplace and bring back the virus and infect my wife. She's my best friend, so. As a courtesy to her, I've canceled all in-person talks and everything else, and I'm on to Zoom. And I hope that what I do on Zoom will inspire you in some way or entertain you in some way, but certainly move you in some emotional way. And to start off with, there was a couple of things I just wanted to say. First off, the president of your organization there locally, Bill English, I've heard that he's ill and sick, so I hope to get an update on that sometime, but I send him my prayers and hope that we all keep him in our hearts. And you got a guest there that she's apparently, Claudia Edge has apparently moved to Utah. And I was a big supporter of her book. I don't know if you could see that on the screen, but We Touched Heaven. I wrote the foreword for it. I enthusiastically endorse this book. It has one of my stories in here, which I might be coaxed into talking about tonight. And I'm honored to be speaking to this group. I was going to come there years ago. I think Ions was going to do a conference there. And well, COVID came. And speaking of COVID, I started my morning off with a little miracle. My niece and nephew were both in the hospital in ICU with COVID in Sacramento. And my nephew went home. But his wife, my niece, they told the family that she had 3 days to live at the most and come say goodbye. And they did that a week and a half, almost 2 weeks ago. And they forgot about her. I don't know if you know what's happening with medical care right now, but if you're not fully, you know, able to survive, they don't give you a lot of attention. So a new doctor came, a woman doctor, and saw her laying in the bed there and decided to spend some time with her and some energy. They drained 3 liters of fluid from her lungs, did a tracheotomy, and she had a 50-50 chance a couple days ago because she was still in a coma. She came out of the coma this morning, and she talked to her family on Facebook or on FaceTime on the phone. And so that was a beautiful thing. She went from zero chance to now she's out of a coma. So for those people that have been going to my timeline and reading about it, thank you for your prayers and intervention. I really am a believer in prayers, and I'm believing in the power of positive thinking, positive prayers, and positive actions. So this is a near-death group, so let's start off and get right to the heart of matters. I had 3 near-death experiences. My earliest one was when I was 8 years old. And at 8 years old, I was taken to the county hospital in San Jose, and they told my parents that it was probably too late. I was coming in too late. I had real bad lung problem. They were filled with fluids. I had infectious disease. I had a kidney disease. Kidneys were getting ready to fail, all kinds of stuff. And they put me on a gurney. Parents left, and I was left in the hospital. As it turns out, I was in the hospital pretty much by myself for 1 year. I missed all of a third grade, except for a week or two. And didn't see school again until the fourth grade after it started. So my first few days in the hospital, I was taken into a room. They stuck some needles in my back. They pulled fluids out. My lungs were just filled up. I couldn't even breathe. Put me to bed. I was 8 years old, and I was in an isolation ward all by myself. Nobody looking after me in a dark room. And while I was there, I was getting weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. And all of a sudden, as I'm laying there, it's like I'm not breathing anymore. There was no breath. And next thing I know, my body is feeling light. And I mean that both ways, light like weight or lack of weight, and light like light energy. And I'm kind of floating up into a sitting position. And when I look back, I see this 8-year-old boy laying there in the bed. And I knew that wasn't me. That's not me. I'm this spiritual being. I'm this soul that's rising from it. And I rose up and I'm looking around the room, and the room is like getting lighter and lighter and lighter. It's like clouds in the room. That's the best way to describe it. And on these clouds was like a moving screen. It was like images and things, but it was real. It was like vision of the future. And I'm watching these things unfold, and I'm just feeling so loved. It felt like the angels themselves were hugging me. It was like, if those of you have an Italian grandmother, you know what I'm talking about. If your Italian grandmother comes over and hugs you, you know, and does all this stuff to you, imagine a million of them doing that to you at once. That's how it felt. It was beyond love. It was pure bliss, pure joy. And hang on a second. If whoever's controlling this thing, if you see people coming into the waiting room, I'd be clicking them in. But if somebody could do that, I'd be not be distracted. So there I was, and I start seeing events in my future life. And I figured right off the it was like I'm watching a newsreel, and I see my wife that I have, that I just been talking about earlier, my wife of all these years. And she's in high school, and I recognize her face. I go, well, I'm only 8 years old, but I recognize this woman. I'm going to meet this girl later on. I go, that's the one I'm going to marry. And I knew that. And then I saw the president of the United States. As it turned out, it was John F. Kennedy. But I'm 8 years old, and this is 1950s, early 50s. I didn't know who Kennedy was. I had no clue in the politics of what was going on then. But I saw this man in like a presidential motorcade and everything, and I saw the assassination of John F. Kennedy from this bed. I'm watching this thing on the screen. And then I'm seeing my life in a war. And in this war, there's helicopters flying around. And I didn't know they were Huey helicopters or anything. I didn't know what the country was, but it was Asian. I knew it was in Asia. And I saw the vision of what was going on the battlefields from this seat that I'm sitting inside the helicopter behind a machine gun. And I'm watching all these things unfold, these events. And one of those events, which is actually in Claudia's book, We Touched Heaven. And I talk about where I committed mutiny, actually disobeyed a direct order. And I say it because I knew this, you know, what I didn't really mention in that story was I seen this thing unfold already. I knew that what I was being asked to do wasn't correct. It wasn't what they thought it was. So let me kind of give you that story, and then we'll get back to the near-death experience, because I think this is a good place to fit it in. In my vision when I was 8 years old, I saw myself sitting behind this machine gun, and I saw people on the ground, and I'm being asked to shoot at them with my machine gun. And when the actual event happened in Vietnam, 1967, I had a new major who was a pilot, and he's flying me around, and he's telling me that was the enemy marching down below on this dirt road, and that I should open up with my machine gun, which fires 750 rounds a minute, and decimate them, basically, because they're in an area they're not supposed to be. It's right off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It's a little hamlet there, and it was considered enemy territory. And I couldn't pull the trigger on the weapon. I knew, I've seen this before when I had my near-death experience. I knew this didn't feel right. It was super deja vu because I've seen it before. And I knew it was wrong. And the major told me, he says, I'm giving you a direct order. And this is combat. I'm giving you a direct order. Failure to do so, I'm going to court-martial you. And I told him to court-martial me. I said, it's just not what you think. So then he asked the gunner on the other side of the helicopter, there's one on each side, each door. And on the other side, that guy flown with me for about 5 or 6 months. And he goes, I've been with Bill McDonald long enough that if he says he feels something's not right, I'm not doing it. So then he decides he's not going to fire. So we got two soldiers in this aircraft, me and my door gunner, refusing a direct order in combat, which in the military, when two or more soldiers refuse orders, that's considered a mutiny. That is life in prison or the firing squad. It's either death or life in prison. That's it. There's no other. So had I been wrong about disobeying this order, that was 1967, I'd still be in jail today or dead, and so would be my door gunner, because the Army doesn't fool around with this kind of thing, which is sad, but that's a fact. So I felt a little responsible going with my feelings, because it was okay, because I knew this was okay, but to have this door gunner courageously disobey orders because he believed in me, that's a lot of responsibility. Finally, the pilot goes, he says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, let's go down. If it's the enemy, I'll fire at him. But if it's not, I'm not firing. So we flew down, made a real quick pass over him, and nobody ran, nothing else. It turned out what he thought was troops marching in black pajamas like the Viet Cong were children going to the community vegetable garden with a Catholic priest at the front. There was a Catholic priest in Catholic black clothes, robe, and there was all these children in black pajamas, and they were all carrying on their shoulders rakes and shovels and hoes, implements of gardening, not war. Had I obeyed the orders, had I followed orders, I'd been legally correct to do so, and I'd been morally and ethically wrong. All those lives would have been shattered. Plus everybody on that crew, our lives would have been changed forever. So I've made it a point with my ministry for veterans and work with military and stuff. I really teach people moral values. I don't care if you're in a battle, in a war, you still have a higher authority to answer to. Just because you've given a direct order to do something, if you know ethically, morally, spiritually, that is wrong, then suffer the consequences. Say no. And you could suffer a lot of consequences. But unfortunately, we don't teach our military that. Anyway, to get back to the hospital bed where I was at, that was just one of the things I foresaw, like the Kennedy assassination. And then I saw marrying my wife that I have today. And I saw my children. I saw grandchildren. I saw everything unfolding for 50 years. I was 8 years old, and this vision went on to events in my life, taking me up to almost 59. And at the time, I thought it was kind of funny, because why these events were going on, and I'll touch on some of them later, but as these things were going on, there was a set of numbers. It looked like 29, and it was floating around in this vision. And then when it flipped over in the 29, it turned the 2 over, and it looked like 59. So it was like 29, 59. So I didn't know at the time. I thought, well, maybe I'm going to die at 29. Maybe I'm going to die at 59. I didn't know. And when I finished having these visions and I came back, my whole life, to say it changed, I was already kind of on a path of meditation and prayer. I was really into that lifestyle of seeking, but it just firmed where I wanted to go with my life and what I wanted to do. And when I was in high school, I went to the school principal and I went to several people a couple weeks before the Kennedy assassination in November of 1963. And I'm telling the principal and everybody, hey, the president's going to get shot and killed in Dallas, Texas next week, you know, the week after, whatever it was. And everybody just goes, yeah, okay, fine. Now, you know, if you'd say something like that today in modern Facebook and you post stuff like that, I would have had Homeland Security at my house asking me, how did I know that was going to happen, right? But back then it was just like, yeah. And then when they made the announcement on the speakers in the classroom on that morning of November 22nd, 1963, that the president had been shot and killed, it kind of came back. And a lot of people got very quiet around me. It's like, well, how'd you know that was going to happen? Now, what's interesting about the Kennedy assassination was I've seen the official reports on it. I've seen the Warren Commission reports on it. I've seen the news on it. But, you know, when I saw it as an eight-year-old, and when I saw it for multiple visions leading up to the actual date of the assassinations, several mornings in a row, there was more than one shooter. So maybe I got that part of it wrong. But in my visions, Oswald wasn't the only guy. So that was the kind of events that were happening. And I went into the Army in 1965, and I ended up in Vietnam. And I had really some most amazingly strange, mystical, no way to label them as anything but supernatural experiences. One of those was I was flying on what they call a command and control ship. It's a Huey helicopter, which I was a door gunner on and I was a crew chief on. And we were supporting some South Vietnamese ARVN troops. Okay, these were Army of the Republic of Vietnam Rangers. And they were engaged in a battle against North Vietnamese regulars that came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail into the Hobo Woods, Iron Triangle area, or someplace in there. And they just shot up 9 helicopters in this area, and they all went back, and the gunships went back. And we were the last ship left, and we were way up in the sky watching the battle because we had the commanders for the ground troops up there, and they needed to get down. So we had orders to drop these guys down into a landing zone, an LZ, where they were engaged in combat. It was really close combat. And I had orders, do not fire your weapon. So I'm getting shot at, and I got orders, don't fire your weapons because we don't know where the good guys are at. We don't know where all the bad guys are at. So I'm sitting there with my machine gun. I got orders not to fire. Consequently, when we're coming down and starting to land, we're the only target in the sky. Everybody, 500 people opened up on us. It was like, boom. And my helicopter was just riddled with holes and stuff. We bounced down onto the ground. Everybody gets off. One of the ground commanders for the South Vietnamese Army, turns out he was a double agent. He was like an officer in the South Vietnamese Army, but he was actually a sympathizer or actually one of the VC. So he gets off the helicopters and he sees a guy run out in front of him. So nobody's watching him except for me. I turn around and he's aiming an automatic weapon, an AK-47, I think it was. And he has a clip of about 18 rounds in there and he opens up. And this clip of ammo, 18 rounds, goes right into my body. Now, prior to that day, about 2 days before, somebody in the company said, hey, McDonald, we got these chest protectors that are made out of really heavy. Nobody wants to wear them because they're hot, they're sweaty, they're you know, but you want to try it out? And I said, yeah. So I had just been wearing a couple days this thing across my chest like a bulletproof vest. And nobody knew if they'd work or not. I was a guinea pig. So I'm wearing this, and one round, the first round comes, and it hits me square in the heart, blows this big hole in this chest protector, ceramics fly all over, flames are shooting out about 6-8 inches, and there's smoke pouring out. And other rounds, they came at me. I saw the light of these rounds coming at me. It was like 18 bullets coming at me, just one hit. Anyway, so we pull up and we got so many bullet holes that we only get about a football field length away, about 100 yards, and we crash land in a field. Battle's going on at one end of it, we're at the other end of it. The VC, the bad guys, the North Vietnamese, they're just a football field away from us. We land. I realize that I'm not dead. I mean, I had some shrapnel in my hand or something, but other than bleeding in the hand, I had no bullet holes in my body. And so I let the pilots out. And then I noticed that the gunner sitting on the opposite side of me, we're on opposite sides. I'm facing one way, he's facing the other way, but we're back to back. And there's a transmission between us and two walls. On my side of the helicopter, no bullet holes behind me, nothing. But on his side of the helicopter, if he took and drew my profile where I was sitting, there were 17 holes, exit holes, but no entry holes. And plus it had to go through a big old transmission. So it was like impossible. So somehow those rounds came, one hit me in the heart and the rest disappeared, went through a wall with no holes and come out with exit holes on the other side. So he's the gunner on the other side's laying over to his gun and he's got 17 holes in him. He's bleeding all over the place. There's blood flowing off the floor of the helicopter. And so I pick him up, put him on my shoulder, and I go, I'm running. I get away from this helicopter. So I'm carrying this guy about 150, 160 pounds, and that's about all I am at the time. And I'm running at full speed, and my back is kind of feeling it, but I didn't feel it at the time. And so I get a good distance away. We call in, and they bring in a small helicopter. It can only take two people, and it took the major on the ship, the company commander, and it took the wounded, real bad wounded gunner. And they left me and the other pilot. And they go, we got him a room, and they left. And it was like 8 hours later or so before anybody come back for us. So I went back to the helicopter, and I took a machine gun off the mount. I put 2,000 rounds, onto it. It was all straight tracers. And I actually decided to attack the North Vietnamese. And so anyway, make a long story short, I was eventually rescued. I didn't get killed, spoiler alert. And I was put in for a Silver Star that day. And I got a Distinguished Flying Cross and a Purple Heart. And we get back and they go back and recover the vehicle, the helicopter. And they bring it back to base camp and everybody's out there looking at it and they got the Army investigated. And I mean, they actually sent out investigators because they couldn't figure out how 17 rounds could exit from one side with no entry holes on the other side. So that's one of these things that I was even contacted by the CIA about 6-7 years ago, wanting to figure out how I did that. That's another whole story for another day, but, so I was having things like this happen to me in Vietnam. I knew who was going to get killed. I knew who was going to get wounded. I know what airplanes or what helicopters were going to crash. And regardless of what I said to people, I really couldn't seem to change the destiny of these people. It's like I finished flying one day. I landed. My helicopter was going to go in for maintenance. I was going to get a day off. And the company sergeant major, whatever he was, he came to me and he says, "Hey Mac," he goes, "we're short on people tomorrow. Do you want to crew a ship tomorrow? You deserve a day off, but I got nobody. Can you go?" I said, "Okay." So I go over to this aircraft, this helicopter, and as soon as I touch what they call the skin of the helicopter, the sheet metal, the metal that's on the side of the helicopter, the body of it, I had this instantaneous vision and my hands were like, they were burnt. It was like heat. And I saw just in a matter of moments, this thing twisting in the air, crashing in the jungle, and all these bodies falling out of the helicopter on fire, exploding, burning, and everybody dying. And I saw that in hundredths of a second. I knew it. That's what's going to happen. So I knew something was wrong. And intuitively, I realized there's something wrong with the rotor head, the rotor blades come off of. There was something wrong with it. it was going to freeze up and it was going to be a malfunction. So I took the maintenance book for it and I wrote a big red X in it, which means something's wrong with it. It needs to be fixed and it needs an inspection. And they told me, and I put on your something wrong with it, which is not very technical. So they send out a tech guy and he looks at it and he goes, I don't see anything wrong. He says, no, no, the rotor head. And I insisted, three people checked it out and they all said nothing's wrong with it. And they wanted me to sign it off. And I refused to sign it off. I said, no, this thing's going to crash. It's going to burn. It's going to kill everybody on it tomorrow if this goes out. And so I went to see the company commander and I told him, I said, you can't let that aircraft out tomorrow. It's going to crash and burn, which they thought I was crazy, nuts, delusional. And I was given another order and said that I'm going to be brought up on charges. Because I got an order, I'm supposed to fly that. And if I don't fly it, I'm in trouble. I said, well, what? Send me out on any other mission you want and I'll still face the penalty if you want to do that. But I ain't going out on that, and nobody else should. So I went back to the flight platoon, and we had this, what they call hooch, in this building, and we got, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 bunks in there, double bunks, and the crew sleeps in there. And they had a new guy come in, Alger Durrell, and he transferred from Saigon, where he had a job where he was, when I say computer, this is 1967, so it was IBM cards in a machine, right? So they put things on. But he had an air-conditioned building, and he lived in a hotel. But he volunteered. He wanted to be a door gunner, which is, if you do any research, you find out door gunners probably had the shortest life expectancy in the war. I mean, they're getting killed all the time. So when I shook his hands, they introduced him to me. I started started crying. I said, whatever you do tomorrow, don't go out and don't go on that aircraft. And he wasn't on the flight schedule and he didn't have his flight physical, didn't have any gear. And he looked at me like I was crazy and he laughed at me. And I walked away. I said, you'll never come back if you go out tomorrow. And I meant it. And everybody thought I was crazy. So I get up the next day, I go flying. That aircraft, they were having trouble finding a crew for it, the one I refused to fly. So it wasn't in the air. So I was happy. I flew. I come back about 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon after on combat missions. And I noticed that that helicopter is gone. And I'm mad. So I go see the company commander. I say, hey, why'd you let that aircraft out? The guy let me know that he's in charge. He's a major. I'm just an E-5. I'm an enlisted man. Don't tell him what to do. And I said, where's it at? He says, well, it's late. I said, what do you mean late? Well, it's about 4 hours late. Well, it only carries enough fuel for about 2 hours and something. So it's not just sitting in airspace someplace. It's falling out of the sky. So then a bunch of pilots decided that they were going to go search for it. They had no idea where it was. Nobody knew where it was at. So they jokingly around said, well, you know McDonald. These guys says, let's see how good he is. Let's see if he knows where it's at. So they called me over the aircraft and they go, you want to come with us? I go, yeah. So I get on a helicopter and they get up to about, 1,000 feet or so. And they go, okay, Mac, which way? And without hesitation, I just point out in a certain direction. I go, that way, follow that way. And believe it or not, they did. So they followed it. And it's just, sun is just getting ready to go down. By the time we get up there, we travel about 15 minutes. All of a sudden we see like a forest fire. Big fire going on in the forest, and we pull up to it, and we circle around, and there below us is that helicopter, totally twisted, crashed in the trees, the blades wrapped around it, and there's 8 bodies, including that young man that I told not to go out. He was lying there all burned up, laying in the jungle, and to make a long story short, it got kind of quiet. Nobody wanted to talk to me. But later on, when I made more predictions and more things happened, people got spooked out. But I knew enough to take care of me, and those that listened benefited from that. So anyway, Vietnam, if you read my book, I have written some books, by the way. my autobiography, Warrior, which has military stories, and they're all mystical, spiritual in some way. And then it has my life story before, when I was 2 years old, meditating and all kinds of things happening, a year in the hospital, all the neat things that happened, my first near-death experience, and marrying my wife and going back to Vietnam and Machu Picchu, and all kinds of neat things. So that's Warrior. It's on Amazon if you want it. Now, I remember in that story about my near-death experience, I talked about 29 and 59. Now, when I got out of the hospital at 9 years old, I intuitively realized I need to change my diet. I need to take care of my body. Something's going on here. I got future health problems. That's what I saw on my little thing. Future health problems unless I changed. So I did. I became a vegetarian. I didn't drink alcohol, didn't do drugs, didn't drink caffeine, didn't do any of those things. I was really, really clean living, did yoga, meditated, did all these things, exercised. And yet, later on in life, when I was 58 and a half years, almost 59, remember 59, I go to India on a trip, and I go to this sacred cave. It's called Babaji's Cave in the Himalayas. And on the way back from that cave, I have a heart attack, a seizure, all kinds of stuff happen. I pass off, and I fall off a 30-foot cliff into this ravine. And I land on this big boulder about the size of a Volkswagen Bug. And I'm laying there looking up at the blue sky. And my heart went from hurting, boom, 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 to no pain, no nothing, no beat, no pulse, no breathing. All of a sudden, I'm laying there going, oh, nothing wrong. And the next thing I know, I'm getting closer to the clouds, and I can see my friend on the cliff looking down at my body was. I look down, I go, my body's down there, but that's not me. That's not me. That's just the body, right? And I'm up there, and all of a sudden, I'm looking down, and I see a cobra, a large cobra snake, crawling across my feet. Now, normally, first off, I love cobras. I love snakes. But it was the excitement of seeing this cobra. It was like love. It was really a strange thing. And all, next thing I know, it was like the cobra was like giving me paddles, like clear, juke, and I just jumped back up out of my body, and I stood up, and this big, and I say big, I have no clue how big this snake was because it was coming out of the grass, across my feet, going into the grass, so I couldn't see both parts of it, and I'm grabbing it, and my friend is yelling at me up on the cliff thinking I'm crazy. And I'm grabbing it, and I'm grabbing this snake, and I'm chasing it. But it was like the cobra jump-started my life. So that happened in 2004, like in November. But being a typical man, I finished my vacation there and did a bunch of stuff. And it wasn't until the end of January when I have another heart attack that I actually go see a doctor. I collapsed a couple of times. I think, well, you know, maybe it's time to go see a doctor. So I'm having this, I know it's a heart attack, it's pounded and everything. So I don't want to make my wife worried. I just said, you know, I'm having some kind of problems. I think I'm going to go down to the doctor and get it checked out. And she says, I'll drive you. I go, nah, okay. So I drive myself to the ER while having a full-blown heart attack, find a parking space in the hospital parking lot, get out, walk 10 minutes across the parking lot, get into the ER where there's a line of 20 people ahead of me, stand in line, get up to the front. They give me a clipboard to fill out. Nobody, you know, the only question they asked was, they didn't ask, are you having a heart attack? Are you bleeding? The only question they asked was, do you have health insurance here? Which I did, but it was like, that was their only question. Their only concern was I covered? It was really strange. It kind of stood with me, you know, going, geez, I could be dying. These guys want to know if I got insurance, right? Anyway, so I get the clipboard and I fill it out. It takes a few minutes. Then I get to second line. There's only about eight people ahead of me. I finally get to this nurse. She's sitting there and they had a question on her. What's wrong with you? And I said, I'm having a heart attack right now. And she reads that and she laughs. She goes, sir, we'll be the judge of that. She says, how'd you get here? Oh, so I drove my pickup and I parked it over there. And she says, and you were in that line, you're in this line? Yeah. And you're having a heart attack right now? And I said, yeah. I said, but I'm like this. I'm very calm. She goes, yeah, okay, fine. So she gets out her stethoscope and her stuff and sits me down. And she, all next thing you know, she's ringing a bell. Code something. Code blue, code something, some number, some color. And next thing I know, they strap me on a gurney and they're running me into this room for a doctor. And he wants to immediately do something. I'm going, what? He says, sir, you're having a heart attack. And I said, yes, I know I'm having a heart attack. That's why I came in. Yeah, but you, I said, no. He says, no, it's really bad. We it's going to take multiple stents or we recommend, you know, bypass surgery. And so then I moaned and groaned and complained to him. I go, well, you know, here I am. I'm almost 59 and I've led a healthy life. I don't, no caffeine, no nicotine, no alcohol, no drugs of any kind, nothing, right? I'm clean, you know, boom, I don't eat meat. And the guy looks at me, the doctor, and he goes, sir, Mr. McDonald, then I knew he was serious. Went from sir to Mr. McDonald, and I knew he was serious. He says, had you not taken such good care of yourself all your life, he says, with your genetic background here, the way I'm looking at your body and everything, he says, I would have guessed that you'd been dead by 29. Now, if you go back to that original thing where the numbers were going 29, 59. So there I was, I passed 29, but now I'm just a few weeks from my 59th birthday and they want to do this heart procedure. So I'm going, wow. So I said, let me think about this. I don't want to jump in this. So they gave me a weekend to think about it. They were not happy with that. They wanted to immediately do it. And I was calling up my schoolmates because we had a reunion coming up and they wanted to know who I wanted to see at this great reunion. And I said, well, you know, I want to see my old buddy, Paul O'Brien. And that's because Paul O'Brien and I were both born on the same day in the same hospital in San Francisco, just a couple hours apart. And we, you know, shared the nursery together and our mothers were in the same maternity, you know, room and everything. But we never knew any of that until fourth grade, about 40 miles away in Silicon Valley in a town called Sunnyvale, where we discovered that, hey, we started life off together. So I just wondered, because I wanted to meet him and say, well, here's a guy, if you believed in astrology or anything else, this would set the record straight, right? So when they tell me, oh, Paul's dead. He died this year. And I'm going, wow, he didn't make 59? So I didn't feel really great going into the surgery. But anyway, I had the surgery. It was done. So that was my second near-death experience. I had a third one later on, but I thought it'd be more interesting to explore some other areas. I generally like to talk what I call chicken soup of the soul kind of things because, you know, near-death experiences, it's like, okay, those happen. You got to be practically dead. These other spectacular things happen. Great. But for the real spiritual journey, real neat things happen. For example, I live in the Sacramento area and I had some friends coming up and they wanted to go rafting down the American River right through the town of Sacramento. Not something I lived there forever. And it's like something I don't normally do, but they wanted to do it. So we did it. And I'm on this raft and we pull off on a beach to take a break and we pull the raft off and I look about 50 yards down the beach and I see a big commotion or it looks like they're pulling somebody out of the water. And being a former lifeguard, I started to run and I get all the way down the beach and I see all these young teenagers standing around doing absolutely nothing, just looking down at the sand of the beach. I'm going, so anyway, they dragged this kid up, he was a 17-year-old boy, and they got him laying on the beach, and he's white, ashen white, no pulse, no breath, no heartbeat. He was underwater about 9 minutes. He's dead. They go, oh, he's, you know, people, other people, he's dead. So I'm mad at these people. I go, no, man. You know, so I get there, I push everybody aside. I prop up his neck, I clear his mouth, I open his head back, I do all these things, and I start mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And this is the old-fashioned way, you know, mouth-to-mouth. And it goes on and on. I don't give up. I'm going on and on. All these teenagers just stand there looking down at the ground. And I'm just thinking to myself, why didn't they do anything? Why didn't they do anything? So finally, if you've ever given mouth-to-mouth, you know, when somebody comes, when they finally come around, they upheave everything into my beard, into my mouth, everything, and all. And so I clean myself off. He stands up, and he's alive. It's like, wow. And so, and I'm looking at this 16, 17, had to be 16, couldn't have been 17. She was really young looking. And I look at her, and I go, what's wrong with you people? Your friend is laying there dead. Nobody's doing nothing. And she stopped me. She says, oh, no, mister. We weren't doing nothing. I said, you're just sitting there looking down at the ground. She says, we were all praying. And I said, what? She says, we were praying that Jesus would send somebody that knew what to do to save our friend. And then she looks me in the eye and says, and you came. And I didn't know what to say. It was like, so I was speechless. But it was like, it hit me that she was absolutely true. It was actually a truthful statement. They weren't doing nothing. They were doing what they believed. It was a total, I looked at the parking lot when I left, and there was a bus from San Jose. It was a First Baptist Church in San Jose or something like that. And it was a church group came. And so when their friend drowned, they just prayed. Nobody knew first thing about first aid, life-saving, nothing. And that was the first time I'd been down that rafting area, the first time I was on that beach, something I'd never do, hadn't done since. And so was that all coincidence? Was that all a sequence of events that just happened? I don't think so. I really think in the divine scope of the universe, we're all kind of part of the divine plan, whatever it is. And if we're open to it and we're receptive and we make ourselves available to be used, things like that happen. For example, if I have time, I don't know how much time I have here, but I will continue. I do want to answer questions here. I kept having this feeling every morning I'd wake up, and there's a passage from the Bible that talks about beware of strangers because there goes an angel in disguise, something like that. There's a famous little quote that comes out of that. And I went into a bookstore and I picked up a book, and I just happened to randomly open the page, and that was that quote staring at me for some chapter. And then I go to a dentist's office and I pick up the Guidepost magazine, and I'm looking at it, and that's the quote that they got, same exact quote. And I'm going, that's twice. And then I got it a third time from another source, and I'm going, well, I've had that three times this week. So I knew there was somebody waiting for me to help, somebody waiting for me to be there for them. And so I was alerted, and intuitively, I was alerted. So I'm going to work on a Friday, and I'm a management person. In the middle of my workday, I mean, I still had hours to go. Middle of my workday, I just up and tell everybody, I'm going home. I didn't say I was sick. I didn't say I had something to do. I just walked out of the building. I said, I got to go. And nobody stopped me. Just, I got in my pickup truck, and I'm driving from Sacramento, and I go by the Kaiser Hospital on Highway 99 in South Sacramento, and right into Furnace Road, going on the road, there's what it turns out to be a 17-year-old young man. He's hitchhiking. He's got no belongings. He's all wet because it's raining. He's got socks on his hands for gloves, and he's wearing a T-shirt. And I'm going, this is crazy. So I pull over. I'm only going a couple more exits down. And I said, where are you going? He says, going to Texas. And I said, well, I ain't going that far, but hop in, you know. So he gets in the car and he smells. I listened to his story. He's been 2 weeks hitchhiking on his own, sleeping in fields and having a rough time. He was a former foster child in California. When you get to be 18, you're out of the system. They turn you loose. And so he found his grandmother and he went and stayed with her in some little town up on the north coast up by Eureka. And then she died on him and he had nobody. And so he heard that his father was in Austin or Houston or someplace. And he was going to hitchhike to Texas, see if he could find his father. That was the only plan that he had. I said, okay, come on. So I took him down the road and got to my exit. I said, don't get out. Go to my house. So I come to my house and he just smelled and he was dirty and he was ragged. And I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to feed you lunch and take care of you. But here, go in here, take a shower. There's clean towels. Throw your dirty clothes out here. We'll take care of them. And I'll get you some stuff to wear. So while he's in there showering, I threw away his clothes. They were garbage. And I gave him my clothes, you know, extra clothes, jacket, sweater, sweatshirt, t-shirts, socks, everything. And when he comes out, I give him these clothes to wear, and he's all clean now. And he sits there, and I pitch him give him a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and some milk. And I gave him a backpack. And in the backpack, I had camping gear, you know, a shelter to build. I had a flashlight, lighter for starting fires. I had everything. I even put food in there, canned food, other kinds of food, and I stuffed some money in the pockets of it. So if he was going to be out on the road, I figure let him be able to, and then I get rain gear for him. So he's sitting there and he's telling me the story, saying that he was out the night before by that hospital, Kaiser Hospital, South Sacramento. There's a big open field there. And he just laid down his sleeping bag and he was sleeping there in that field. Didn't have a tent or anything or shelter. And a rain came. And his rain bag got ruined. It got soaking wet. And he was miserable and he got chilled and he was shaking. And he said that he didn't want to live. And he was thinking about ending his life. He was actually suicidal. And he thought about ending his life. And I'm listening to that. And then I had a real life vision of a man who looked exactly like you, wearing exactly your clothes. And then I stopped him. And the man told you, God loves you. And then he broke down and cried because that's what this vision, the guy said, God loves you, right? And then I said, one more thing to make you believe what you just experienced. I went into everybody's got a junk drawer in the kitchen. We got a junk drawer, but in there, there was a pack of sugarless gum that was about half used. And I pick it up. I don't know why I pick it up, put it in my hand, and I go like this, and I put it out, and I put it in his hand, and I said, now when I give you this, you'll know that everything you experienced last night actually happened. I don't know why I gave it to him. And he looks at it, it's a pack of sugarless gum. And then he broke down totally because in the vision, the man gave him a pack of sugarless gum, used, not even a full pack. So there's a case where I knew this guy was needing help. I knew he was out there waiting for me to help him. And I listened to my intuitive voice. And I did everything I could for him. And that happened about 1990. And I prayed for him and kept him in my vision of love and sending kindness and prayers to him. What's that? 31 years? Still praying for him, someplace in Texas or wherever he's at. So I don't forget people. But those are the kind of things, if you're really open, things like that happen. I got a bunch more stories like that, but I'd like to open up for questions if people have questions, because without seeing people with no audience, I don't know if I've lost everybody. Everybody's asleep. Everybody's going, oh, God. You know, so hit me with a question, and then we'll roll on to some more stories. So if somebody wants to open up there, Greg or somebody, if you got questions coming at me, unmute.
We do have questions. The first question is, what do you see for the future?
Okay. I think I was telling Craig this earlier today. I've told it just a couple of people. In 2019, the summer of 2019, I did a radio show in Budapest, Hungary. Is that where it's at, Hungary? And it was not live. They wanted to be able to edit it in case I said something they didn't like, or I don't know. So they interviewed for about an hour and a half, and they edited it down to a smaller chunk, fit it into an hour show. And at the guy got through listening to all my neat stories and things and stuff, then he had a throwaway question. He asked me that same question. What do you see? Now, this was summer of 2019. And in 2019, I tell him, I said, there's a world plague coming. It's going to shut down borders, shut down schools, shut down work, shut down airlines. It's going to shut down jobs. It's going to bankrupt people. It's going to bankrupt countries. And I said, in America, this plague will kill, in 2020, will kill at least 300,000 to 400,000 or more people by the end of the year in 2020. And this guy raised his eyebrows and stuff. Yeah, a plague, right? I didn't know what kind of plague it was, right? All I knew there was going to be disease. And then I said, it ain't going away. I said, it'll be there 2021. It'll be there 2022. I said, but we'll learn so much from this that when the great plague comes, the one that's really much worse, we will have the tools at our disposal and the knowledge developed from all we're going through now during that period. So this guy's rolling his eyes like, what the hell? And I said, then in California, I went on, and I saw the recording, the little red light went off on the screen. It wasn't recorded anymore. And I said, in California, I call it the California apocalypse, financial, you know, could be a real bummer for the San Francisco Bay Area and LA. Homelessness in California is going to go crazy the next few years. I said, cost of living is going to go crazy. People can't afford to rent. And I said, drought continues and the fire storms will be worse every year for several years. They'll be worse. They'll be setting records. California is going to burn up millions and millions of acres. And this guy's just rolling his eyes. And I said, it's not an earthquake. We'll get earthquakes, but not a big earthquake's going to kill California. It's the drought, not having water and having all these fires. And then eventually that'll bring, when rain does come, there'll be mudslides and there'll be all kinds of other stuff. And it's the homelessness. California is going to have an exit. There are going to be people leaving California for Idaho and Arizona and Texas and other spots. They're leaving. I said that's the 19. So somebody asked, well, so I'm kind of glad that he didn't eventually edit all that out and he didn't show it, because it's really depressing. Because what I really want to tell people is this. Even though there's stuff coming, And I think some groups of people I know, some friends of mine, I mean, they got 7 years worth of food in their house. They're ready. You know, I'm not going to throw rocks at them, because I'm looking at it saying that's a good idea. Have reserved food. I don't know if you need 7 years worth, but have food. Just times are going to come where price of food is going to go crazy. Shortage of food is going to go crazy. And in certain states, Louisiana, parts of Texas along the Gulf, Florida, California, Oregon, Washington, there's some economic havoc coming because of Mother Nature. So you need a supply of food and everything else. But I'm really not a doomsdayer, even though I say this next three decades are going to be terrible for natural disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, earthquakes in California, eventually everything. We'll have it all, and the fires will continue. But I believe in the positive. We will survive it all. People will move to different places. We will survive. And people will get tougher. And I also believe that when hard times come, people reach down into the spiritual. And they start looking at why we're here. What's their purpose? What's my relationship with the Lord? And if And if that is the result, that's a good thing. So that's a good thing. So it turns people to examine those things instead of just keep enjoying times are good. Then let's just keep the party going. So, yeah. But I also see, I see people eventually, not right away, eventually we're all going to get tired of fighting each other. And we're going to start reaching out and say, this is crazy because nobody's getting anywhere. If this side's fighting this side, we're all tribal, this party against that party, against this state, against this religion. If it'll reach a point where people will become a little bit more tolerant of each other out of necessity. And people are going to get tired of fighting. And so I see that as the upside. I see spirituality growing. And I see great growth in not necessarily religions, although some religions are going to grow really great. But I see people supporting their religions, both financially and with their work and with their efforts and with their love. So if people turn to that, I am happy. So hope that answered your question, but I don't want to be a doomsdayer because I also see beautiful things. I mean, I see us coming up with some cures for these viruses and stuff. The fact that we did so much on this current virus, it's only going to help us for the next one. When the bad one comes, we'll be ready for it. We've learned a lot of lessons. So that's good.
Next question.
Hope that answered the question.
Is there anything that you would recommend that people do to have visions of their own?
Okay, I'm gonna get onto my favorite subject. Everybody looks at, when they meditate or they pray, they look at God as Santa Claus. They're always going to God for what they want. They don't go to God and say, God, give me what I need. What they need maybe is a slap in the head and they wake up, you know. But no, they tell God what they want. Oh, don't let my 96-year-old grandmother die. Like God doesn't know it's her time. Or I need transportation to work, so God give me a new Mercedes-Benz instead of just I need transportation to work and maybe my neighbor gives me a ride. I mean, what you need and what you want are two different things. So let's get down to people seeking out what I call mystical experiences. And I've had, if you read my books, you name it, it's happened. I've been through it. But I've never gone out of my way to have that experience. When I pray or meditate, spend time with God, it's only one thought on my mind. I'm in love with God. I'm spending this time with God. I'm not going to God and ask for anything. My faith is such that I know I will get what I need. God has a list. He knows what I need, right? So I don't have to tell God what I need. So if you're going there for, if you're praying and meditating and living this great life because you want to be able to astral travel or, you know, read minds or, you know, mystical stuff, well, that's great. But that's seeking something and that satisfies the ego. But what has it done to get you closer to God? So what you have to ask yourself is, do you want God, love? Do you want God? Or do you want these mystical powers? Seek first the kingdom of God and everything else comes. You seek God because you love God. And if other things happen, they're gifts. But if you're going for the gifts, you're forgetting about the gift giver. And that probably stepped on a lot of toes. I'm sorry. But I'm really very childlike about this. To me, I love God like a child loves his father or his mother. I don't need gifts. And people go, oh, well, you had all these experiences. I've read your books. All these things always happen. Never ask for them. They just come. They're gifts. So, yeah, there's people you can bring in and talk to this group, and they'll tell you how to do it. I'm telling you, love God first. Seek first the kingdom of God and everything else to come. Everything else is a detour. I don't want to lecture because I'm a minister, but it's like, no, seek God. That's the goal. Seek God. That's probably not the answer you were looking for. Sorry.
That's wonderful. Perfect. Next question. Do you have any more insights from your NDEs about this next big plague that you've mentioned?
Yeah. All right. There's another big one coming. I saw 3 decades of garbage going on, and California and Louisiana getting the worst of it, Florida getting some bad stuff. But this next plague, it could come sooner than I think. I'm thinking it's a few years off, but the way things morph. But I feel really good about it, because I really feel that we've learned something. Even though we fought each other, and everybody's it's gotten political, the medical and everything, and I'm going, forget all that. Eventually people are going to say, what worked? What really worked? What can we document? Right? And we're going to come up with cures. Because right now we got a virus that basically, even though there's dozens of people in my family have it, it's an amazing percentage, but it's only a small, it's like what, 1% in the hospital, less than 1% are in the hospital. Now, if you get a major one, I'm talking one that hits 10% of the population. You're talking millions of people dying, millions of people in the hospital. We can't handle 10 times the workload now at the hospitals. So we will be smarter. We'll be able to be ready for the next one. Realize that this plague was cyclic. The world has had about every 100 and some years, there's another bad plague. It's been a history of it, sometimes 75 years, sometimes 150, but always around 100 some years. We always have some natural plague comes. I call it a plague, you call it diseases, whatever, but it's a bug we haven't experienced. And until we, as a society, learn to deal with it, we're going to have to, this current one, it's not going away right away. It's not going away. So we got to learn to be safe. We got to be practical. When you're in public, wear a mask, do all those things. I don't want to give people a lecture on that. You know what to do. I wear a mask everywhere I go. I'm thoughtful for others, because even though I got my vaccines, I found out I could be a carrier. Well, I don't want to carry it to my wife or anybody I love. So I do it for others. Everybody has their own reasons. So I hope that answers your question, but I'm not greatly worried about these real bad things coming, like California. Obviously California is going to have a major, major earthquake coming up eventually, but it's overdue 150 years now. So who knows? We've had 1,000-year floods and 500-year floods 3 times in a decade in some states. And people are going, wait a minute, this is supposed to be 1,000-year, 500-year floodplains, and they've already flooded 3 times in the last 10 years. So you never know. Mother Nature is in charge. You know, we may think we got control. We don't have control of that. So to me, the best safeguard against the next plague or anything else is get your spiritual life in order. Be kind, be compassionate, love your friends, love your neighbors, love your families, love your enemies. If you can do that, we're all going to survive together. Everybody's going to help each other.
Next question was, someone told me that everybody who gets the vaccination will eventually die, but then I heard from a religious leader that I should get the vaccination. So I did. Did you have anything about this in your visions?
I got the vaccines. My wife got the vaccine. My son and daughter, my grandchildren all got it. Now my nieces and nephews. Now, let me tell you the story. I'll give you anecdotal piece of information. I got a niece in the hospital right now. Been in a coma for a week and a half. She just came out of the coma. She didn't get the vaccine. She didn't believe in it. She didn't believe the virus. She didn't believe any of that stuff. It's all fake. It's all phony. Her and her husband were in ICU for a week together, and she's been in the hospital for almost a month. She was told she was going to die. The family went and said goodbye, and somehow she's surviving. No shots. I got another niece and nephew, and their son, all three of them, work in a hospital. They got their shots because they believe in them. They got COVID. They felt a little sick for a day and a half. They missed 10 days of work, and they're back. End of story. They just like to have, they didn't feel good for a couple of days. All right. My daughter's mother-in-law, she didn't get the vaccine. I'm going to church. I'm going to sing. I'm going to hug everybody. She did. Almost everybody in her congregation, including the preacher, all got COVID. She died 6 days later. And on her deathbed, she said, "It's not COVID. It's not real." She died an hour later. All right. My daughter's husband's brother's parents or mother-in-law, father-in-law, they're both in the hospital with COVID because they didn't get their shots. So that's anecdotal, but I've known probably 30 people in the hospital didn't get their shots. And I know nobody in the hospital that's had them. Now, that's just anecdotal. I mean, that's just people I know. So I'm saying science outweighs opinions. Somebody sends you something on the internet. Oh, I'm a medical assistant. That's a nothing. I've heard it. It's like people give you diet recommendations. People don't eat this, don't do this. You tell somebody you're sick and everybody gives you medical advice. Be real. If you want to roll the dice, roll the dice. But if you don't have the vaccine and you infect somebody else, this weekend I was scheduled to talk. Everything was paid for. I had hundreds of people coming to a big revival. It was just me. I'm one speaker. I was given a free 3-day spiritual retreat in North Carolina. It was all covered. I canceled it because I'm going through all these airports to get there. I don't want to carry a bug, and I don't want to be responsible for affecting one person in that group. So I personally take, you can do whatever you want to do, but I take personal responsibility for who I am and what I give to this world. Do I think everybody's going to die if they get the shot? Yes, everybody will die that gets a shot. Guarantee it. Everybody's eaten bread. Everybody that's eaten bread in history has died eventually, right? So are they all going to die in 5 years? No science behind that. And they say, I don't want to be tracked. They got these things in here and Bill Gates is going to track me. I think, well, if people believe that, why don't they take the vaccines at random and take them to a lab and show me? Nobody's taking them to a lab. Nobody can show that. That's not true. But people say that. And people that I love, like relatives, people I love and respect, and they buy into this stuff and it's killing them. And I just go, my heart hurts for them. I can't force them. Well, I have a right to do this, you know. Well, yeah, great. So I remember smokers telling me that when I was on an airplane. They're smoking. Well, I have a right to smoke on this airplane. Now you can't smoke on an airplane. We could tell them not to smoke because it was bad for other people's lungs. This is an example. But if you think somebody's tracking you with this vaccine, then don't take a cell phone anywhere because you're tracked. I mean, and if you got one of those workout things, you know, on your wrist that following you around on your route, you're tracked. You know, so I don't personally believe any of that. I'm not going to beat anybody up if somebody does believe that. I'm not going to argue with anybody. If you ask the question, did I see anything in my vision? What I really saw in my vision was a lack of love between people. But I see that ending eventually. I see eventually people waking up and realizing, well, 5 years from now, they realize, well, nobody died from that. People are going to start to realize whatever the truth is. I tell people, don't buy the truth from anybody to experience it. And don't pass along any information unless you know for a fact it's true. I don't care where it's from. Don't pass it along. Don't become part of the chain of misinformation or propaganda on either side. Just don't go there. Life is a lot easier and more loving than people give the credit for. We're here to love. We're here to be there for each other. So this disease that we're going through worldwide, instead of pulling people together, like we're all suffering together, let's help each other. That would have been the optimum, way to react. We've gone the opposite, and we've taken political sides and anti-vax sides and vaccine sides, and some of the most beautiful people I know on opposite view of mine. Do I unfriend them? No. Do I argue with them? No. Do I have this discussion with them? Not unless they ask me a question. And then I'll just give my answer and I shut up. So I hope that answered your question, I think.
Thank you. Two questions. Number one, do you have any more information about the time frame of this tribalism as you described it? And then at that point, after you answer that, maybe any parting or final comments you have, because we'll be out of time at that point.
Okay. So I really believe, I think highly of people. I believe in people. And I've met family. Okay. This group would understand. When I was a child, I had nothing. And I mean, I had nothing. We were skipping meals. There was no food bank back then. I mean, I was going to Assembly of God Church, and they brought by groceries for Thanksgiving because we had nothing. But meanwhile, I had this neighbor, and I didn't know anything. I was like a little kid. I didn't know anything about it. She told me she was a Latter-day Saint. I didn't know what that meant. She told me she was a Mormon. I didn't know what that meant. And she had like, I don't know, six kids. And I was just, I went to her house every day, and she fed me, told me stories, treated me like one of her own kids. She had such a heart of gold that when they moved, I felt like I lost a family. It was a beautiful experience that to this day, I remember how she treated me and how she made me feel. And it's made me want to do the same thing. So the point of that story is this. If you're out there giving your love and giving your kindness and your compassion, you will infect others with the same thing. People will feel it. They want to give it. They want to share it. If you're out there beating people up because of their political beliefs or the beliefs on this and that, and you're right, they're wrong, and you know, it's not love. So take a look around. If what you're doing leads others to love. So if you want to change others, change yourself. So be the change. In other words, you want to help some, you know, you really can't help anybody. Ultimately, everybody has to help themselves. They have to heal themselves. They have to teach themselves. They have to forgive themselves. But when you start with yourself and you learn to love yourself and forgive yourself, and know that God forgives you, you know, so why can't you forgive yourself, right? So that's really the answer. The answer is love yourself, forgive yourself, be grateful for all you have, everything you have. Don't look at what you don't have, what you want, and appreciate what you got, and be open to the gifts that God gives you. If God gives you cancer, look at it as a gift. Well, what do you mean to give you cancer? That's not a gift. I met a man, and this guy came to me, and apparently, from all I can gather, his family said the guy was a SOB. He was a terrible person. Wasn't speaking to any of his three wives, his family, his kids he hadn't talked to in 10, 15 years. And I mean, and the guy was never there for anything, and he was a terrible boss. He was rich, but he was a terrible boss. And he went to the doctor, and the doctor says, you got stage 4 cancer. You're going to die. So he came to me because he heard I was a healer. And I said, wow, that's a great gift. He goes, what do you mean a gift? I got 6 months to live, you know? And I said, God is letting you know you got 6 months to get your stuff in order. You got 6 months to make right all your relationships for your children, for your ex-wives, for yourself, because it's not so important how you came into this world and all the stuff you went through. It's most important in how you leave this world. And you want to leave people missing you. What have you done for them? What have you really done for anyone else? Well, he didn't understand. He got mad at me and everything. But then later on, I found out that he took that same thing and he started thinking it was a gift. He says, okay. And then he called up his wives, didn't tell his wives or his children he was dying, but all of a sudden he was there to give him some money and some support, listen to their stories. And next thing you know, he was a part of their relationships. In 6 months, he was just, and then he died on them. So at their funeral, when I told him that he'd come to me and he had 6 months left to live, they didn't know that. They didn't know because he never told them he had 6 months left to live. He didn't go to them for mercy or ask for forgiveness or feel sorry for him. He went there to love and serve them. And to me, his life became a success at that point. And when he left, his family cried for him. They mourned for him because he became the person that he was capable of being. It's never too late. It's never too late. We're here for one reason, to love and to serve. And that if you're a school teacher or a mother or a father or a police officer, military, politician, it doesn't matter what you do. If you do everything for God, you know, if you see God in everybody, we're all made in his image. If you see God in all, then everything you do is service for God. And then I tell people, don't be a hypocrite. Whatever group you belong to, if you're a Mormon, if you're a Catholic, if you're Jewish, whatever you are, honor your religion. If that's what you are, don't be half in, half out. Follow it. You know, be real. Because I think loyalty and loyalty is huge. So be loyal to something and somebody. So I don't know if that helps anybody out or touches anybody, but there you go.
Thank you. Delightful, delightful, wonderful words of wisdom. And thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. We've all been blessed by having you speak to us tonight. We thank you for it very, very much.
Well, thank you. I like speaking. I speak to as many church groups as I normally do. I really miss not speaking in public. I mean, I spoke 750,000 people. In India, I was speaking to thousands. I mean, it was really, when you get people gathered together looking for spiritual inspiration, and diversity of religions makes no difference. They're all seekers. And if they're all there seeking the same thing, and I'm trying to tell them what you're seeking is love. It's God's love, right? And that is the mana. That's the mother's milk. That's everything. That's the currency of life. It's God's love. Seek it. Hang on to it. Embrace it. Aches and pains and things, they all go away. God is always there. All right. So, if you got my email address, if anybody has any questions, they can email me or Facebook me. I got a YouTube channel. I got all kinds of subject matter. And if the people are interested in more mystical stuff, I got all kinds of mystical stuff. I mean, I could talk about that sometime, but I really think people need to focus now. It's more important to focus now on the tools that we need to become more spiritual.
Thank you. You're very kind to be with us. And we invite everybody who's been here to join us again next month, fourth Friday, 7 p.m. Thank you, Reverend Bill McDonald.